Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Well, we're going to talk about how we live out our faith every day, and it's oftentimes in the everyday aspects of life that we see faith really take root, take hold, and grow. I'm Neil Stavem. Great to have you along. Thanks for tuning in to Connecting Faith. Ted Ross at the controls, and Chris is the phone. And Ted, you know, both you and I had the opportunity to grow up in a family where your parents were committed to the faith, and you know, having a godly mother goes a long way.
It really does, yeah. Even if there's a period of wandering away from the faith, those seeds that were planted from a young age take root later in life.
So we'll talk about moms today, particularly. It's a little course that maybe you've heard. We're building every day at our work and at our play, not with hammer, blow on blow, not the timber sawing so. Building a house not made with hands, following Father's perfect plans. Little builders, so all are we, building for eternity. And it's kind of a kid's song, but it's one that our guest today heard plenty of times growing up. And I resonated with the story as well as we get into it. Len Sweet has been on my list of people to talk to for some time. And just he writes prolifically and got great content. And so we've been meaning to connect with him. And his new book just came out, and it's the perfect opportunity to welcome him back to Connecting Faith as we talk how our heritage shapes our story. And the book is called Mother Tongue. And let me introduce Leonard Sweet, who holds the E. Stanley Jones Chair at Drew University. He's founder and president of Spirit Ventures Ministries, also served as a distinguished visiting professor at George Fox University. And one of the leading figures in the emerging church movement and a major figure in discussions about Christianity's transition to post-modernity. And a popular speaker, written a number of books, including Jesus Drives Me Crazy, Soul Tsunami. It's also one that he and his friend Frank Priola just wrote not too long ago, Jesus Speaks, Learning to Recognize and Respond to the Lord's Voice. And with that, let's jump in and have a conversation about Mom. Len, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Good to be with you, Neil. Thank you for having me.
You know, I was just mentioning you've written a number of books, and I know several of them recently have been focused on helping us understand how Jesus speaks to us or how we can find him throughout all the scriptures, you know, Old Testament and New. And now this latest one talks about, I guess, as I was reading it, that, well, it's just one of the other ways that God communicates to us, and that's through our mothers. So probably shouldn't surprise us, but as you started putting this book together, I'm sure you probably realize that's just another way that God really helps us understand who he is.
Yeah, well, the book was really written, too, to try and remind the church and the Christian parents specifically that we've for too long outsourced faith development to the church, and it's time to bring it back into the home. And my book came out about the same time as the Benedict Option did, that Rod Dreher has done.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so it's kind of a case study of what the Benedict Option has looked like in the past. I hope we wouldn't do it the same way my mother did it, but it's a real case study of what that Benedict Option was in the life of this one family who lived on Hungry Hill. My mother raised three kids. Neither of my parents had a college degree, and yet none of us got any money at all to go to college, and yet we all had PhDs. So it's quite a tribute to mother what she accomplished on this little postage stamp of a lot on this place called Hungry Hill. And so it was a hard book to write, but a fun book to write.
And as you say, you just kind of took different aspects of life at home and, you know, memories, and really kind of touched on all the senses, you know, maybe just sort of tastes and smells and sounds and all those things. But maybe introduce us a little bit to your mother, because she maybe wasn't the typical mom of three boys in terms of her faith journey.
Yeah, it was a late marriage. My mother didn't, and my father was a little younger than mother, but mother didn't get married until She was in her mid-30s, didn't have start having us till she was in her late 30s and early 40s. She had a ministry ahead of that. She went to God's Bible School, which is a Bible school that she didn't graduate from high school. She just went right to the school and learned Bible and then became a home missionary and then got ordained in the Pilgrim Holiness Church and was an evangelist and church planter and young people's worker and a musician. And so she kind of filled a lot of cracks in the church for many years and had quite a ministry. We buried my mother from the church that she founded and was its first pastor in a little Pilgrim Holiness. Now it's Wesleyan Church in Covington, Virginia. So she was an early woman evangelist, preacher, Bible teacher, church planner.
That was fairly rare at the time, wasn't it? It was
very the holiness tradition always had a place for women in ministry, but it was more in theory than in practice. And so Mother's one of the few that actually did the practice, although she got in a lot of trouble, as I tell in the book, so that's part of the fun part of the story.
Well, and of course, there's enough trouble that you got in too, and we'll maybe get into some of that if we have time. But we'll save that for the end to kind of build to that.
Yeah, right? So I hope we all get to that. Yeah. No,
I think a lot of listeners resonate with some of the anecdotes and the habits that your mom had, daily responsibilities raising her family, because she really took it on as when she, you guys came along, she in. You know, through, I guess, various circumstances, kind of pull back from her, church planting and evangelism outreach. And so then she's taken on a new charge, and that's raising up little boys to be godly men.
Yeah, and she had a mantra. I think I mentioned this in the book. If I didn't, I should have. Her mantra was, she called us boys. She said, boys, I'm not going to isolate you, but I am going to insulate you. Hmm. So she meant that she wasn't going to isolate us from the world. We were to be in the world. She had this real good sense of in the world, but not of it. So she's not going to isolate us from the world, but she is going to insulate us. And the place where she believed you got insulated was in the home. And she didn't outsource faith development to the church. She took personal responsibility for insulating us in the Christian faith. And so we got a high R factor insulation. We had family prayer twice a day, first thing in the morning, last thing at night. We had Bible study, always in Bible study, reading, Bible memorization. At age 5, we started having to memorize 12 verses a week, and 12 weeks on, 12 weeks off. And so we were heavily padded with that insulation, and we kind of became mother's little mini church, where the Bible says we're two or three, and we were five, and the five of us, my mother, my father, and my brothers were 1 year apart. I'm the oldest, and so we were her little congregation, and she sent us to the public school, but she homeschooled us in the faith, in Christianity.
Well, we do have to maybe just talk a little bit. Example of is finding a church home, because that changed a little bit, because there was a time when a television came into the suite home, and that created a little bit of stir at the church.
Yeah, that's when we were Free Methodist. My father was Free Methodist. My mother was Pilgrim Holiness. I call Pilgrim Holiness the Marine Corps of Methodism. I mean, they were. It was close to Amish as you can get. The women showed no skin and didn't bob your hair, and that's where Mother got in a little trouble. She bobbed her hair at a wedding, and you couldn't wear any jewelry. When you got engaged, you got a watch. And my father was a Free Methodist, and he gave my mother a ring, and so she got in trouble with the Pilgrims. So, and we became Free Methodists, and Frees, you couldn't have television was the devil's blinking box. That's what it was called, the devil's blinking box. So I grew up watching the radio. We'd sit around the radio, and my father would choose the things he wanted to listen to, and we'd all have to. There was one program in particular, Let the Lower Lights Be Burning. It was from Boston, a rescue mission, and he loved that show. And any rate, at age nine, my father finally said, I want to watch Bonanza. It was Bonanza that brought the whole thing crashing down. And I tell a little bit about the impact of Bonanza on Sunday Night Worship, because the church thought it could take on culture and win. You can't take on Disney and Bonanza and win. And all I had to do was back up Sunday Night Worship, just 1 hour, just back it up a little bit. But no. The church said, no, we're going to take on pop culture. And so my father finally allowed a TV into the home. I didn't know what the big fuss was about because we got to watch 2 hours a week, 1 hour on the weekend, which was usually, you know, something my father wanted, and the other was 1 hour during the week. So this whole furor over this television was a mystery to me. But so we got kicked out of the Free Methodist Church. My mother had then gotten ordained in the Free Methodist, and so her ordination was removed, and she was defrocked, and the church exercised a ban on us. So that's how I became Methodist. Methodists will take anybody, and they were glad to get this sweet family. So my father tithed, and so the people love that. So, so that's how I'm a Methodist to this day. Thanks to that church taking us in. But yeah, that TV got in us a lot of trouble.
You're getting culture's changed a little bit. Then Len Sweet has been watching culture for a number of years and writing about it. Writing effectively, he's the E. Stanley Jones Professor of Evangelism at Drew Theological Seminary. And author of a number of books, some I think probably 60, and this is one of his latest. It's a great read. It's called Mother Tongue, How Our Heritage Shapes Our Story. And Len, in a moment, will open up more of his mother's memory box and help us all remember as we experience together, understand the process of how our own heritage affects our legacy. And as the subtitle suggests, our heritage shapes our story. That story for Len Sweet was shaped much by song, and we'll talk a little bit about the story in song coming up in the moments ahead here on Connecting Faith. And speaking of song, one of those old gospel songs that a lot of us grew up with, we'll hear a little bit of that right now from David Crowder.
I wonder if so aimless, life filled with sin, I wouldn't let my dear Savior in. Then Jesus came like a stranger in the night. Praise the Lord. I saw the light, no more darkness, no more night. Now I'm so happy, no sorrow inside. Praise the Lord, I saw the light. Oh. I walked in darkness and clouds covered me.
To me, wonderful words of life. Let me more of their beauty see. Wonderful words of life. Words of life and beauty. Teach me faith and duty. Beautiful words, wonderful words.
That's an old, great old gospel song, one that Len Sweet grew up hearing time and time again. We're talking with Leonard Sweet today. Len is one of the world's most influential evangelicals, as a sharp cultural critic who helps us see how to get in front of the future rather than be bowled over by it. And one of his greatest influences was his mother, and he's written about it in a great new book called Mother Tongue, How Our Heritage Shapes Our Story. And Len, talk about the upright piano in the home and the music that was a regular part of your discipleship.
Yeah, and I talk about the importance of a soundtrack. Faith needs a soundtrack, and this culture needs a soundtrack. I mean, this culture, the language is story built around an image, but it has to have a soundtrack. I mean, if you look on YouTube and see some of these, you got some songs out there that have 2 billion hits. We got 7 billion people in the world, and 2 billion of them have bothered to go to YouTube and listen and like a song. It's just amazing the power of a soundtrack. And the Bible does say faith comes by hearing, and the importance of the ear gate, the ear gate. And the soundtrack for me was after family prayer of an evening. Mother didn't do this before we went to school, but of an evening, last thing we did before bed is have a family prayer time. And we always prayed on our knees. That's what the holiness people did. You prayed on your knees. You got up. We hugged Mother and Dad, and then we went upstairs. She dismissed us to go upstairs to bed, and then she would go to the upright piano, and we would call down for as long as we could stay awake songs, hymns that we wanted her to play, our favorite hymns. And so she would tuck us in musically every night. We grew up with a soundtrack to faith. And when I deconverted, as I tell the story in the book, at 17, I deconverted from Christianity. But for about 6 years, I was just an atheist. I became a Marxist, at one point even a Maoist. But what kept me tracking was that soundtrack. I could not escape that soundtrack. And that soundtrack helped bring me back and bring me back stronger than when I left. So I can't say enough about the need for a soundtrack. And it was a soundtrack that I learned in the home. And it was a soundtrack that we shared as a family unit. It wasn't just everybody had their own soundtrack. We shared a family soundtrack.
You know, even though, you know, you're mother and father weren't, you know, college educated. I mean, they were going, you know, to make sure that you had education. I mean, you all took your turns at the piano, right, and other instruments as well. So, I mean, that was,
we did. Yeah, music was not an option. We had we got to choose. We all had to learn the piano, but we got to choose what else on top of the piano we wanted to play. And my middle brother chose a guitar. My youngest brother chose the clarinet. I chose a baritone, but my band director chose a bassoon for me because he needed a bassoonist. So I didn't really get to choose. I got chosen for me. I hated the bassoon, but I didn't want to disappoint my band director. So, but yeah, we had the music part was huge. And you know, this is really amazing to me. I didn't mention this in the book, but we have an image of Jesus preaching. If I say to your listeners right now, give me an image of Jesus healing, they can do it. Give me an image of Jesus eating, they can do it. Give me an image of Jesus preaching, they can do it. Give me an image of Jesus singing, they can't do it. But we know he sang. He had there's a hymn book in the middle of the Bible. It's called the Psalms. You never, a good Jew, never said the Psalms. The Psalms were meant to be chanted. And we know Jesus sang a hymn. It says there in the Bible that before they went out, he went out to the garden, the Olive Garden. He and his disciples in the upper room sang a hymn. We also know the last thing he did, he ushered himself into eternity singing a hymn, Psalm 22, the greatest song ever sung in the history of the world. Jesus sang from the cross, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? And the psalm ends, it is finished. We understand that Jesus is singing. In that psalm, there's I thirst. I mean, those things that we call the last words of Jesus were really part of this song, at least three or four of them were, that he sang on the cross. So the soundtrack is so huge and important. Yeah.
I'll let you catch your phone.
I'm sorry about that.
No, it's all right.
Turned it off.
Yeah. It's your brother calling to see if you still have a favorite song. No.
Yeah,
exactly. He wants to, yeah. You know, that is, you know, and one of the ways to, I mean, you're one of the great things about this, you know, story that you've collected is that your mother took every opportunity to really shape your life and your story. In fact, those, you know, the insulation, as you will, of the faith inculcating it, that, but it scripture comes through hymns as well. And just, in fact, I know she also helped you celebrate the God in nature, right? I mean, she was a mountain girl, so she appreciated the rocks and trees.
But all those rocks, she related to biblical images and stories. You know, every rock she always brought it back to the scripture, to the story. I mean, Jews don't put flowers on their grave. They put a rock And so I learned all this stuff growing up because mother was always associating nature with, you know, when we got the cedar, we looked at a cedar tree, we knew those were the cedars of Lebanon. That's where they came from. They started there, you know. And so part of how I learned the whole story, and a heavily verse, I mean, it was all about Bible verses. And so I got an acute case of versitis because the whole Bible was sliced and diced into these verses. But what enabled me to see it as one story and to kind of reconnect with it after my deconversion as one story, I say from Genesis to the maps, it's one story. And what enabled me to do that was mother's constant, everything in life she would bring back to that story. Well, that's here. You find that here. You find that here. You know, that's Gideon. Well, that's Elijah. That's so everything in our house. And the reason I tell the book, I tell the story in the book through material culture. They said evangelicals don't have material culture. That's Catholics have material culture in their faith, and evangelicals don't. We're all about the Bible and verses. And no, but we do, and we don't appreciate how we do. But I mean, I grew up with Bible verses framed on the wall. I mean, we didn't have pictures. We didn't have holy pictures. We had holy verses. That's still art. That's still material culture. And so I try, and the book is organized. I tell stories through things, through artifacts. But I also, in my home, with my kids, everything in our house has to have a story. If it doesn't have a story, it's stuff, and we don't surround ourselves with stuff. So that's part of spring cleaning. You know, we get rid of it. So everything has to have a story. And so with the kids, it's passing on those stories. I mean, by everything, I mean chairs, lamps, everything has to have a story. And I try and find a way to tie all those stories to the biblical story, to the greatest story never told, because we don't know it as a story. We just know it as these sliced and diced up points and verses. It is the greatest story. And this is a culture where that's how they communicate, is in story form. And so we need to learn how to speak to this culture with our story.
We've just got a minute before the break. Well, maybe we'll hang on to it after the break because we won't have time to get into it, because I want to find out more about that. If there were times when, you know, your mother sort of developing the story and said, well, that doesn't, you know, that seems like a stretch. It's like, you know, okay, is that really the Bible story? Well, we'll find out more about that. Also, we need to check in about an experience or two when Lennon's brothers would come home and Mom was gone and wondering, okay. wondering what had happened there.
Now you're scaring me.
I know, well, sure, because there's some of us that you know grew up in homes like that too, and say, you know, if the rapture's coming, are you ready? We'll find out. Find out if Len was ready. Len Sweet joining us today, author of some 60 books, and the latest is called Mother Tongue: How Our Heritage Shapes Our Story. And we'll talk more about how our heritage affects and shapes our legacy. And we'll celebrate moms together here in just a moment on Connecting Faith.
You're listening to an encore presentation of Connecting Faith.
A lot of us on our march to Zion can look back at the godly heritage growing up in a home where Mom and Dad were diligent about living out their faith, sharing scriptures, teaching us, training us, discipling us, correcting and reproving and all those things. And Len Sweet is sharing a bit about his growing up years, told in a new book called Mother Tongue: How Our Heritage Shapes Our Story. Len is the E. Stanley Jones Chair at Drew University, a professor of evangelism there, and a visiting distinguished professor at George Fox University and Tabor College, and he's written a number of books. And a great writer, and just having a conversation today about those experiences growing up in a family where mom was determined to train up her boys to be the godly men that they should be. You were talking, Len, about that we find God in the rocks and everything else. I mean, were there times where you said, "Well, you're making that story stretch too far"?
Yeah, I did, and I just pushed mother all the time. I was the doubter. My brothers were much more pliable and acquiescent. I was the one who fought her and struggled with all this. Tried to put everything through an intellectual grid, you know. And so mother and I had a lot of fun arguments, and they weren't so fun at times. So, but yeah, as I look back on it today, though, this is part, mother really didn't understand this, but this is part of Jewish culture. Jewish culture is a religious requirement to ask questions. And from day one, you're taught as a Jew that the Torah is strong enough to take on anything you can bring it. So bring it on. And so that's why the Jewish table, these Jewish kids they're used to debating and arguing at table. If you look at Judaica, some of these paintings of Talmudic scholars around a table with the Torah open, they're all flailing their arms and arguing with one another. But the mother had the sense that bring it on. You know, there's nothing you can bring on that the story can't take on. So you don't think there was a whale big enough to swallow Jonah? Bring it on. Let's debate it and let's talk about it. And so that's how I grew up with this. Mother wasn't afraid of asking questions. There was kind of this Jewish sense, and she didn't, I don't think, related it to that tradition, but there was this bring it on. The story can take on anything. And we were strict inerrantists growing up. That, you know, mother was a strict inerrantist. Every single thing in the Bible was not just, you know, inspired and infallible. It was an inerrant. So we had some massive arguments growing up, but she encouraged it. She didn't rebuke us for doing it.
Well, speaking of afraid, you do tell a story and made me chuckle. And we probably had some experiences like that. You come home after school one day and mom's gone. No one seems to be around, and your first thought is, "What if the rapture's happened?"
It wasn't just one day, though. I mean, this happened a bunch of days. It was the most terrifying moments of a young kid's life. I was the oldest, you know, so I felt responsibility for my brothers. We're all a year apart, but I was the oldest. And I knew they weren't going to be caught up. We were pre-tribulationists, you know, that you were going to be raptured before the tribulation. Of course, the tribulation is the release of the devil and Antichrist and all this stuff. And this was reality for us. And we were brought up expecting Jesus to return any minute and to be prepared. And if we were found in the wrong place, we may not go. So I come home it was almost, and I knew my brothers were going. So the fact they were there didn't mean anything. If mother, and then I try and call mother, but I couldn't get her. There was always my father, but my father didn't want you to call him at work. He was a low level. He was a teller, bank teller. And I wasn't sure. I knew he snuck out and went to movies, so I wasn't sure he was going either. So I would panic. I'd break out into sweats. I mean, literally, it was just the most terrifying moment. And there was one person, and I've always been sensitive to hang-ups for this reason. I knew she was going, my mother's best friend. Her name was Ruth Kuhn. She died last year, by the way. And I knew she was going, so I'd call her, and if she answered the phone, I would hang up really quick. So I would get some relief. And, you know, to this day, if there's a hang-up, I don't get angry, because you never – I was responsible for many hang-ups growing up when I was a little kid.
No, that's worth reminding. And in reality, we should be living as if Jesus could come back at any day, right? I mean, that would make a difference.
Absolutely.
If we live that way.
Absolutely, yeah. But also, you know, you begin – I live every day as if it could be my first or my last. The first day of the rest of my life or the last day of the rest of my life. And Jesus didn't even know when he said, "I was hidden with the Father." You know, it's the trick question. Is there anything Jesus didn't know? Well, of course, he knew everything. Well, wait a minute. One thing he said, even I don't know the date of my return. So we got to be humble about it. But we ought to expect, uh, we ought expect that hope every day.
Your family was known for their liniment, and didn't always use the medical profession. Maybe that had to do as much with the poverty as anything else. But talk about that.
It did. It had to do a lot with the poverty. But it also, my father's side, Welsh and English, and the first Swedes came over in 1630. And they were these people that were kind of natural healers, bone setters, they were called. So there's a whole tradition of bone-setting Swedes, and it connected me and my story to the healing story of the Bible. Jesus did three things. He spent his 3 years doing three things: preaching, teaching, and healing. There are 40-some healing stories in the Gospels, 40-some healing stories. And we all think of Jesus as a preacher. We think of him as a teacher, but we don't think of him enough as a healer. And what does it mean that part of the gospel, this is, I'm the one that healeth thee. And so that whole tradition of healing and health. In 1524, when William Tyndale translated for the first time the Bible from the Greek into English, Neil, he had to come up with this word that we translate as salvation. What did Jesus do on the cross for us and give us salvation? Now, salvation is a healing word, too. It comes from salve, oil. But his translation, he didn't use salvation. He used the word health, that the gospel brings us total mind, body, spirit, wholeness, wellness, salvation. Mind, body, spirit, all of our being integrated, which is a state of health. So we've got to recapture, I think, the healing function of the gospel and reconnect with Jesus, the healer. I've never had anybody come to seminary and say, everybody come to seminary, I want to come here to be a great preacher. Some say, I want to come here to be a great teacher. I've never had anybody come to seminary and say, I'm here to be a great healer. But that's what we're talking about. We need to learn what it means that that the gospel heals and that Jesus heals.
Len, your mother was very passionate and active in faith, Bible reading, church, prayer time, all those things. Your father may be a little less inclined. You're probably speaking to a lot of people who grew up in similar homes where one parent was much more active than another. How did you perceive that?
Well, Dad was very very quiet, very shy, brilliant mind, but he was always in the background. I never kind of knew where he was spiritually. I knew he was following in Mother's way because he loved her so much, but I wasn't sure how much of it was him or how much of it was Mother. So, yeah, there was a strong mother with tremendous faith and love for Jesus, a father that was, and I knew he snuck out and went to movies. So that made him a little suspect. And he did this behind Mother's back. So I was never sure about Dad's salvation.
So. Looking back, are there conversations you'd maybe wish had occurred and things you'd like to say if you're given the opportunity? I mean, as you said, you took a little 7-year journey in the land of the prodigal before coming back.
Yeah, this is, in some ways, it was the best thing that happened to me because I was so, the dominant environment of the home was so strong, Neil, that it was, there's anthropologists have this concept called liminality, a state of liminality. And the metaphor really is wetlands. What keeps a river, any kind of body of water, fresh and the water pure? Well, it's wetlands. So some of the water has to leave the river, and it has to create this swamp. But it's the swamp is the filter. It's the filtering system that removes the toxins and the poisons and the sediment from the river. And as long as the swamp keeps tracking, those wetlands keep tracking with the river, there will come a time when that water will return to the river, but it will return the purest, most pristine water. because it's all been, all the toxins have been removed in that wetlands. And that's why everybody's now protecting the wetlands, because it's nature's filtering system. And so for me, that deconversion was the wetlands. It was a swamp. I entered the swamp. I lived in that swamp for 7 years. Some people say I sold all oats. No, I planted a prairie and lived in a swamp. But that was the time when a lot of the heavy legalisms and all that stuff that I had grown up with needed to be filtered out. And so I came back, when I came back at 23 into the faith, I came back so much stronger and so much more passionate. And because I had, but I, again, I kept tracking because of that soundtrack. That soundtrack kept me tracking with the river. And I don't know what I would have done without that soundtrack. I have another brother who's a Presbyterian minister. He went to Princeton, got his PhD at the Free University of Berlin. But he again, we talk about the power of that soundtrack to keep you tracking with the river. You just keep tracking it.
This book, Mother Tongue, will remind you of the soundtrack, maybe of your life experience and your journey, and just to remind you again of the those little everyday things, you know, from liniment to yellow cheese to any number of possibilities of things that we don't have time to get into. But Len Sweet's a great storyteller and a wonderful writer, and this is a wonderful tribute to his mother and some great spiritual lessons for us as well. Mother Tongue, How Our Heritage Shapes Our Story, written by Len Sweet, who is E. Stanley Jones Professor of Evangelism at Drew Theological School and visiting distinguished professor at George Fox University and author of more than 60 books. Len, appreciate just sharing a few stories with us today. It was good to reconnect and look forward to chatting down the road again.
Yeah, this makes a great Mother's Day gift, by the way.
No question about it.
May 14th, yeah.
Yeah, it is coming up. Yeah, I'm glad that you know the day, so you're good for us. All right. Len, thanks so much for checking in today.
Thanks.
All right. You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we love the opportunity every other Wednesday to connect with Leith Anderson, president of the National Association of Evangelicals, to talk church culture, faith, and just get a better understanding of the world in which we live. Leith was not only as a director, a president of the National Association of Evangelicals, which is the largest evangelical ministry organization, I guess, in the nation, somewhat. Is it 40? How many thousand members? I mean, it's huge.
Yeah, 40 denominations loads and loads of organizations. And I don't know the exact 45,000 churches. Somewhere.
There we go. It's a big ministry that he oversees. But he also pastored for 35 years at the Wooddale Church in Eden Prairie, has written a number of books. And we always appreciate the perspective that we get. And Ted, today I thought we'd talk about an issue that's been in conversation and the news for the last couple weeks. Sadly, Chicago Tribune looked back in the events in Charlottesville and said it represents a defining moment in our history. How do you see what took place there?
Neil, my heart breaks over Charlottesville, from the racism to the violence to the politics. So the National Association of Evangelicals issued a statement on our website saying that the NAE condemns white supremacy and all groups such as the KKK and the neo-Nazis that champion it. And this is not just about one college town. This is actually, as the Chicago Tribune said, this is about ongoing attitudes and actions in America. So there's so much to be said. But as an evangelical Christian, I start with the Bible and not with the politicians and not with cable news. And the Bible clearly states that all human beings are created in the image of God. And the New Testament, from the very beginning in the book of Acts, is multiracial, not just believers, but leaders in the church as well. And the Great Commission, which as evangelical Christians, we so much believe and seek to practice, that calls us to make disciples of all nations. And the Greek word for nation is ethne. It doesn't refer to Canada and China and the United States. It refers to people groups. It refers to races and languages and tribes and peoples. So when we're talking about heaven, we're talking about people of every race. That's who we are, and that's what we believe. And upon all the Bible stuff is also the reality that most Christians today are not white Christians in the United States. They're in Africa and Asia and South America. So, yeah, there are deep-seated attitudes and deep divides over race in America. And while troubling, I see this also as a time of opportunity to speak the truth of the Bible, that when we have conversations, let's bring the Bible and Jesus into what we say, and that's our biblical responsibility, to stand against what is wrong and to stand up for what is right.
It's a challenge. It's really a challenge. Is it safe to say, Leith, that as Christians we can just boil it down to the simple fact of love everybody all the time without exception? Is it that simple in theory?
Basically, Ted, it is. But the reality in a society where there has been such injustice against African Americans and other minorities that we need to – I don't know if I should use the word specialize, but we need to focus – on those who have suffered the most injustice, and we need to speak on their behalf. And absolutely, we are not to endorse those who speak against the people who have suffered injustice and continue to suffer injustice.
Yeah. I just came across a line from Stephen Bauman, whose new book talks about going from hostility to hospitality. And I thought that really – that is a good descriptor of what we're facing today, because, you know, the idea of reconciliation, I guess, just seems almost beyond out of reach. But clearly, Jesus didn't give us an out, did he?
It's not out of reach. And there are many good examples of what is happening on behalf of racial reconciliation. And as troubling as this is to say, it is sometimes the crises that give to us the opportunity to effectively address injustices and wrongs in ways that otherwise we couldn't have or that we wouldn't have. So we need to seize the opportunity in the time that we have right now.
And one of the things we can do is help the underprivileged. And shifting gears a little bit here in this back-to-school time, the NAA supports an initiative to help serve underprivileged kids in public schools. What kinds of disparity are we talking about with this, and how can churches have an impact?
In terms of disparity, what you get in school, including preschool, actually can shape the whole rest of your life, not just relationships, but the worldview and how you function. And churches across America, in limited but growing numbers, are actually adopting schools to make a difference where children don't have adequate resources, where teachers are undersupplied, where there's not enough food. So what churches are doing is they'll adopt a school, and I say, we say, be specific and be long-term, because many of these children don't have stability. So, yeah, it's a good thing to provide backpacks and notebooks in September, but it's a relationship with that child all school year long. And the best of examples are churches that tutor and befriend and get to know children and teachers in their homes for not just this year, but next year and the next year. And that will transform lives that in turn transforms communities. So churches, take the long haul and be specific.
And I think this is, it goes back to our previous conversation, that it takes sitting down and getting to know one another, right? If it's a suburban working with urban, I mean, we can't just sort of drop in, you know, September with a backpack. I mean, there needs to be a long-term relationship established.
And that long-term relationship starts out by asking and learning, not about telling and teaching.
Well, that's no fun. But that is so true. Leith, another initiative that NAE has been a part of is Prison Fellowship and others have led this, the Justice Declaration. And I'm just curious to know, is that came out, a month or so ago? Give us a little sense of what's happening on that and how people can still be involved.
Well, to build context, the Bible is a lot about prisons and prisoners. So from Joseph and Daniel in the Old Testament to Peter and Paul in the New Testament, there are a lot of prisons and prisoners in the Bible, and there are heroes, many of them. So we care about the issue, and so the Justice Declaration, first of all, read it. You can go to the website of NAE.net or Prison Fellowship or just Google Justice Declaration. It won't take long to read. It's only about a half page long. And what it seeks to do is to apply biblical teachings to America's criminal justice system and to recognize that prisoners are in the image of God, that we need to care for victims of crime, and that we need to update our laws. So let me give you some quick statistics here. The United States has 5% of the world's population. and 25% of the world's prisoners. We lead the world. We have more prisoners than any other country in the world. So we are way ahead of China. We're way ahead of Russia in terms of the number of prisoners that we have. Recently, someone told me that we have more African Americans in prison now than we had slaves in the United States in 1850 before the Civil War. So we need to step up and we need to advocate for changes. And it's great because there's a bipartisan push to do this. I've met with leadership of Congress. There's really a desire to do it. There are states that are doing great. Texas is amazing. And it's biblical principles, proportional punishment, fairness in courts. For example, there's some states that instead of just having criminal courts, they have drug courts. They have mental health courts. So people who have mental illnesses who are then arrested for something are sent for care rather than just sent to prison. And the Justice Declaration seeks to encourage particularly the federal government to address these issues.
Check it out at NAE.net, or you can go to a prison fellowship to read it and to sign it and be a part of advocating for it. I want to go back. We didn't have a chance to talk about this. It was, I guess, maybe a month or two now ago that a noted pastor and writer, Eugene Peterson, was, I guess, caught in an interview answering a hypothetical question about performing a wedding of a same-sex couple. And it's just curious to know how, maybe how we can react to when we hear of things like that, because it seems like there's plenty of folks that have an agenda that are asking those kind of gotcha questions. So what should our response be? Do we pile on and say, he's suddenly out of fellowship?
Don't pile on.
Okay.
We need to be slow to judge fellow Christians. We need to here's the principle. Speak for biblical truth rather than speaking against another person. So speak for what you believe and speak for what the Bible teaches, but don't do it at the cost of attacking other people. I'm often taken back to Jesus' parable of the prodigal son. And in that parable, there is no doubt that the prodigal son messed up big time. His father forgave him and restored him. His older brother condemned him and refused to forgive him. So I want to be the forgiving father. I don't want to be the condemning older brother.
Such a good word. It's so easy to grab your phone and shoot out your opinion so quickly and maybe regret it later and maybe just pause, like you're saying, and take a moment. I wonder what Jesus would tweet,
Well, and often people jump at the opportunity of misinformation. And they've done damage to a fellow Christian, or even if somebody's completely wrong, we need to be really slow to judge, and we need to speak the truth in love.
Any advice? I mean, you pastored for many years. Any advice for pastors when they maybe get into a situation like that? How do they answer questions like that?
Well, most pastors aren't really well trained in interviewing with the press. There's some training that's available, pretty simple, but know what your talking points are. Don't sound authoritative on something you don't understand. I used to have a rule that I would say to all church staff, don't ever put anything in an email that couldn't be projected on screen on Sunday morning during a worship service. And that ought to be the way we generally live, but particularly in terms of the press. Know who you're talking to. My experience, contrary to what some people may think, with the mainstream professional press has been very good, very positive. There are some outliers there that are unprofessional. And so I've been misquoted. I've been quoted out of context, and that's painful when you're misunderstood. But generally, the press is pretty fair.
Yeah. I always appreciate the advice as we talk church and culture with Leith Anderson. It happens every other Wednesday. You can find out more about the great work of the National Association of Evangelicals, all the resources available on their website, nae.net. Leith Anderson serves as president of the National Association of Evangelicals, and I always enjoy talking with you, Leith. Thanks so much.
Always good to be with you.
You're listening to Connecting Faith. If you want to catch part of this program or the earlier conversation, you can find it all posted on the website at myfaithradio.com. Thanks for listening to this Connecting Faith podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. And you can make a gift right now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Connecting Faith, you can subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the awareness and impact of Connecting Faith.